Hello, SciShow Tangents listeners. This is Hank. As many of you know, we record Tangents a few weeks ahead of when it uploads, which is why, in the episode you're about to listen to, you will not hear us talking about coronavirus or social distancing, and none of our tangents are about reorganizing my basement or Sari's podcast recording blanket fort. That will come next week. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay well, and whenever possible, stay home. And whenever you're at home, listen to podcasts. On with the show. Welcome to SciShow Tangents. It's the lightly competitive knowledge showcase starring some of the genius people that make the YouTube series SciShow happen. This week, as always, I'm joined by Stefan Chen.
Hi.
What's your tagline, Stefan?
Meal Prep Marvin.
He's my favorite. I love that YouTube channel. Sam Schultz is also here.
Hello.
What's your tagline?
Just trying to get through the day.
Mm-hmm. We'll make it. We'll bring up the energy soon.
Okay.
I'll do my best. Okay. Sari Riley's also here.
Woo! Energy.
Big energy.
I don't buy it.
Oh.
How do I do it more sincere?
I don't know.
Energy?
No.
That was way better. Yeah. Sari, what's your favorite fundamental force?
Gravity, is that a fundamental force? I feel like without that, we'd all just kind of
Well, that's true of all of the forces.
That's true.
What do we got? Magnetism, is that one?
Electromagnetism, yes.
Oh. Gravity.
Those are the only good
Strong
two.
And weak. All of them.
Is that the only three?
There's four.
What's the other strong one? And weak, yeah. Separate.
What's the other one, though?
Electromagnetism, gravity.
Strong
and weak.
Weak.
Strong, weak, that's just the name of it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have the strong force and the weak force.
Yeah, I like gravity because I can feel it. The rest of them they just are upsetting.
Well, how do you feel the strong and weak force? Will we have to shrink you really small?
The only way to feel the strong and weak force is for them to change, at which time you would instantly die.
Okay.
And I'm Hank Green, and my tagline is Precious Pancake Purse.
What?
Oh.
Every week here in SciShow Tangents, we get together to try to one-up, amaze, and delight each other with science facts. We're playing for glory, but we're also keeping score and awarding sandbucks from week to week, and we do everything we can to stay on topic. But if we go off on a tangent and the rest of the team deems that tangent unworthy, you can get Dr. Sam Buck for taking us on a bizarre and unnecessary journey. So tangent with care. Now, as always, we introduce this week's topic with the traditional science poem this week from me. I'd like it if there were a place that I could go when I was bored, that showed me the story of popsicles or anime or gourds, an intricate exhibit on the evolution of armadillos, a ceiling-mounted chandelier made entirely of pillows, the story of human creation told through the lens of acrobatics, a collection of the best things everyone found in their grandma's attic, the smallest airplane ever built, a Yoda's face stitched into a kilt, an examination of cultural guilt, an education in the kinds of silt. There are just so many great things out there I'd really like to see them. So get in the car. It's time to go. Let's go to the museum.
Oh, boy.
The topic of the day is museums. A museum is a place where you put things. What's a museum, Sari?
Oh, you were almost there.
Wait, of historical or cultural value?
Yeah, I guess. Well, a place where you put things that you want. Well, not just that you want other people to see, because a lot of stuff in museums, other people don't get to see. Mm-hmm. They're just being stored there.
That's true.
Because they're important. And some museums are not open to the public.
Museums started out as just rich people's private collections, where it'd be like your neighbor, Sir George or whatever, would have a fancy cabinet full of fancy plates and weird stuff, a peacock feather, whatever they collected. They'd be like, only my fancy rich friends could come visit me.
Can see the George Museum.
And see the George Museum. Yep. But then around the 1800s, museums in Europe and America, at least, started becoming more public. Mm-hmm. And became institutions that are open to the public with the goal of exhibiting things as well as preserving specimens and artifacts and things like that.
The etymology of museum is almost definitely something about the muses.
Oh, yes.
Just like the place where the muses are would be my guess.
Yeah, it definitely comes from muse and then a temple or a shrine of the muses. Mm. And then that eventually abstracted to like a place of study or school of art.
Is a zoo a museum? I'd say yes.
No.
Why?
It's a zoozeum.
No.
Can there be living things in a museum?
I don't think so. Like, I don't think, I don't, like, when I go to an aquarium, I'm not like, I'm going to go to the fish museum. If I go to the fish museum, I expect to see dead fish.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, that's also at the market.
Mm-hmm. Right. I also expect to see dead fish at the grocery store.
Do you know anything about what made the change from private museum to more public museums happen?
Probably people got rich enough that they were like, wow, nobody likes me enough. I need more people to see my cool things.
Okay. That sounds right.
And then they will tolerate me being a billionaire.
They were too rich to have friends anymore.
It seems like some collections just grew a lot bigger. So like the Louvre didn't open until 1793. And then starting after that, it seems like some other big name museums in different countries that you might have heard of started opening. Mm. The Smithsonian Institution was founded in 1846, and that was just like a rich guy being like, here's a bunch of money to create these museums that are open to the public. Huh. So I think there are enough like rich philanthropist type people, and probably also a push to helping the public get educated in different ways outside of the educational system.
I mean,
like, here, go to a place.
I can't help but notice that 1793 is right in the middle of the French Revolution, where I feel like maybe it wasn't just like, hey, we're going to open the doors. It was like, hey, you sure are killing a lot of rich people.
Hey, we knocked the doors down. This is ours now.
Yeah.
What's 10V1? 16th. Was imprisoned and the royal collection of the Louvre became public. So
it's sort of simultaneous things. They were like, hey, thanks for being a king. You're not anymore. And
cool,
also all your stuff
art.
Is everybody's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, yeah. You know, that's gotta have a revolution every once in a while, I guess. Mm-hmm. And now that we are all defined up, I guess, it's time for one of our panelists, this time it's Stefan, has prepared three science facts for our education and enjoyment, but only one of those facts is real. The rest of us have to decide which one we think is the true one, and if we get it right, we get a sandbuck. If not, Stefan gets our sandbuck. Stefan, hit us with your facts.
Number one, in 2010, researchers in Paris were able to do chemical analyses on a bunch of paintings in the Louvre using X-ray fluorescence.
Oh, more Louvre.
And so they didn't need to extract actual samples from the paintings. And through this, they ended up finding one forged Leonardo da Vinci painting because the composition and thickness of the facial shadows didn't match the techniques that Leonardo was using at the time.
He could have just been having an off day.
Nah, it's a completely different technique, Sam.
It's a whole different technique. Number two, we discovered the remains of what appears to be the first museum to exist, dating back to 530 BCE. Ooh. It operated in the late Babylonian Empire and had labels for each artifact in three different languages.
Oh, cool.
Or number three, in 1954, a meteorite smashed through the roof of the Alabama Museum of Natural History and hit a woman who was visiting the museum. She survived, and the meteor is now part of the museum's collection.
Dope. Okay, so we got fact number one. In 2010, researchers in Paris were using some good science to figure out the facial shadows were wrong and it wasn't a real Da Vinci. Number two, we discovered the remains of the first ever museum to exist, maybe, probably. It was Babylonium from 530 BC. Or in 1954, a meteorite went through the roof of a museum and hit a woman. Now that meteorite is part of the museum because of course it is.
Can you get hit by a meteor and live through it?
Yeah, okay. I know that it has happened.
Okay.
I mean, they can be quite small, so it would just be like a bullet.
Oh, well, okay.
Was she hit in the head, Stefan?
In the leg.
Oh, in the leg.
Oh. Oh,
okay. She's fine.
Do you know if she was from Alabama? What did she say when she got hit by a meteorite? Because I feel
she was asleep.
She was asleep in the museum?
What? What?
Just taking a little nap.
Okay.
I hate this. This, like, story is getting more elaborate, and I don't know if it's all true or
I have seen people asleep in museums before.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been asleep in museums before.
The first museum being in 500 BCE seems...
It seems totally possible.
Possible, yeah. I could see us just finding a pile of organized rubble instead of, like, disorganized rubble, and instead of being... like, oh, this is probably a burial ground. It was like, there's labels, so maybe we're going to consider it a museum-ish,
right.
Even if it was just someone's, like, house.
I love labels, though, where it's like, what's this thing? Oh, They got it in my language, too. I don't know. To me, that says, like, people of varying backgrounds, though probably all wealthy people, came through here and were, like, shown a good time.
Right.
It could also be, like, a grocery store, though. Like, what if it was, like, corn, beans? Other, oh, I don't know when the agricultural
probably
revolution was.
They just looked at what it... or the paleontologists look at what the sign says, and it didn't say corn.
Maybe they thought it was a corn museum, and they were confused.
The Museum of Babylonian Corns. Yeah. They didn't have corn in Babylon, just for clarity.
Wait, yeah, you're right. When did corn become a thing?
That was from the Americas.
Oh, yeah.
And then we have researchers in Paris, and it's weird that the Louvre came up again, but almost, like, this seems like it's something that kind of happened.
Did they previously have to, like, take core samples of paintings when they were looking at them? Is that what you meant by they didn't have to take a sample of it? Or,
well, they wouldn't take a core sample. They would just, like, scrape a little paint.
Like a fleck of paint off of there. Mm-hmm.
I watched several videos of people doing it. It looks so calming. I kind of want to change that to be my career. Just, like, I'm going to chip slowly.
It looks a little bit stressful to me, the painting restoration, because they have to... Like, if they could mess up.
Yeah, if you screw up, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah, chip it back off.
If I screw up now, I'm kind of screwed.
It's true.
If I put a wrong fact on the internet.
I guess so. The thing you're screwing up is way older than that, though.
Yeah, it's old anyway. I could just be like, that crack was there. I can't be like, oh, that fact didn't exist 3 weeks ago.
I think I'm going for Babylonian Museum myself.
I'm gonna go with Napping Woman and Meteorite. I don't know why.
Wham!
Just seems so bizarre.
I love that Stefan's like, oh, she was asleep.
Yeah, like so fast.
I think I'll go with the first one. Is that splitting it all
splitting three
ways?
All three ways. Yeah. Sam wants the Louvre.
It was the Babylonian Museum.
Yeah! Burn, baby. I would have known if some lady had gotten hit by a meteorite. That'd be in my head somewhere.
We'll get to that in a second. So Enagaldi Nana was a Babylonian princess, and her father was the last king of the second Babylonian Empire, apparently. Her museum is thought to be the first museum that existed that we know of, and it dates back to about 530 BCE. She had three career paths. She was a high priestess and the administrator for a school for priestesses and also curator for this museum.
Nice.
Well-rounded.
Yeah, very well-rounded. It seems like the whole family was into archaeology and, like, artifacts of the time, and so they sort of shared those interests. But in 1925, modern archaeologist Leonard Woolley discovered the ruins of the museum in the ancient city of Ur, which is in modern-day Iraq, and they were part of the larger, like, palace grounds. But it was sort of confusing because they found this building where there's, like, neatly arranged rows of artifacts that are from wildly different centuries. Mm. And then the thing that sort of sealed it is, like, this is a museum, was these, like, clay cylinders that had all the, like, metadata for these pieces of art written on them in three different languages. And they don't know if, like, peasants were allowed in, you know, like, if this was just the fancy folk. They think maybe it was used since she was, like, heading up this school for the priestesses. Maybe it was part of their education. Mm-hmm. But the timeline seems a little bit weird because it said that this dated back to 530, but her father was ousted by the Persian Empire in 539. So at the beginning of that decade. But either way, by the end of that century, by 500 BCE, the entire city was abandoned. Wow. And they think there were just severe droughts in that area and the changing climate and stuff.
You know what kind of stuff they were showing?
There was like a statue from 2100 BCE of like a previous Sumerian king, I think.
Nice.
And it seemed there were a lot of like stones with text on them from like older writing forms or languages.
Right.
How accurately do we know those translations? Because I think it'd be really interesting
to read what they guessed that these things were.
That I don't know.
Okay. I can't find it either. I looked.
That's basically all we know.
I love that there's like a 2,500 year old museum where there was like a 1,000 year old artifact.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the articles was pointing out, like, the artifacts in that museum from like 500 BCE were as ancient to them as the Roman Empire is to us. So, meteorite lady. On November 30th, 1954, a meteorite flew through the roof of Ann Hodges' house, bounced off her radio cabinet, and then hit her in the leg while she was napping on the couch. And she was fine, aside from like a gigantic bruise on her leg and hip. there was some like squabbling over who owned the meteorite because she was renting that house. But
it landed on my leg.
Well, it hit the cabinet. It hit the roof.
Yeah.
And then the cabinet and then the leg.
Interesting.
But eventually the Hodges took ownership of it, but by the time they had resolved that legal dispute, the like public interest had waned, and so no one was going to like buy it from them for $1 million. So they donated it to the Alabama Museum of Natural History.
So it did end up there, and she was sleeping, but she wasn't currently in a museum.
No.
I would not tell my landlord if a meteor flew through my roof.
I mean,
there's a hole in your roof.
No, I'd cover it with a poster.
Yeah.
They wouldn't know.
I'd just be like, a regular rock, just that last big storm.
Oh,
yeah. Rock fell through. Didn't have to be a meteor.
Not a meteor, no.
Yeah, you know how rocks fall during storms.
No, but hailstorms? I don't know.
Other people knew that a meteorite had come down because of like the sonic booms and like the flash of the sky. Like, they could tell that something was going on. Mm. And then in 2010, researchers in Paris did the chemical analysis thing. They used X-ray fluorescence to study 7 Leonardo da Vinci paintings from the Louvre, including the Mona Lisa. But they weren't looking for forgeries or anything. They were investigating sfumato. It's a technique that is used to create softer, like, color transitions, which helps make the paintings look more realistic. And they were specifically looking at the faces and, like, the facial shadows. And they found that across these 7 paintings, Leonardo had used different paint recipes for the facial shadows specifically, and that the layers were extremely thin, from 1 to 2 micrometers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's literally all I could find out about it, because the rest was behind a paywall.
So did they find a forgery that way?
No, there was nothing involving forgery.
And he was using different techniques for the shadows?
He used different recipes for the paints that he was using on, I think, across different paintings. So, like, he had changed his recipe, but they were still very
trying
thin
some
layers.
Stuff out.
Yeah, he was experimenting, you know? I really wanted to know, like, how thick normal layers of paint are.
Right, yeah. Is that a lot or a little? Yeah. I don't know. Microns.
But one to two micrometers.
Oh, that type of painting is, that's probably pretty common, because I think they would do tons of layers of really thin paint, and that's why they look like the human skin on those kind of paintings. Look, you can kind of like see through it, or like it has kind of a depth to it.
That's what they tell you to hide the fact that it's real human skin.
That could be they are looking into the phantom zone, and there's a human suspended in there.
Ooh.
That's the secret that you learn in art school.
We're going to take a short break, and then it'll be time for the fact off. Welcome back, everybody. Sam Buck totals. Sari and Sam are tied with 0. Hank and Stefan are tied with 2.
Seems like an extra rude way to say
this
it.
It's a good day.
Tied with 0.
Yeah.
Now it's time for the fact off, where Sari and Sam have a chance to redeem themselves. They've each brought a fact to present to me and Stefan, an attempt to blow our minds. And the fact that is the most mind-blowing will get our Sam Buck. Who goes first? Well, who answers this question most correctly? The Icelandic Phallological Museum contains how many phallic specimens? Give me a guess.
I will guess 1,500.
I will guess 10,000.
Wow.
Wow, so many
phallus. How many phalluses are there? There are 282 from 90-something different species of animal, which is not enough. So I guess that means Sari goes first. I initially would have guessed way more as well.
Would you have guessed 10,000?
But I would have been wrong. In the
that's
five
easy
figures.
To me.
Yeah, just get more.
So after natural history collections and museums started being shared with a wide audience around the 1800s, there was a small hiccup. While vertebrates, like mammals and birds, have bones and skin and feathers that can be cleaned and stuffed as taxidermy to resemble living animals, not all living creatures are like that. For instance, invertebrates could only be preserved in jars of fluids, and plants would look totally different dried versus alive, and any models that people tried to make were made of, like, wax or paper mache and weren't very sturdy. And people had done a lot of 2D sketches and drawings up to this point, but
2D. Two-dimensional.
Two-dimensional. Not 2D.
So I just heard you say 2D.
Like oh, those 2D. Little 2D drawings.
2D. 2D sketches.
I just can't. Okay.
Okay, sorry.
And little two-dimensional sketches or drawings are okay, but three-dimensional sculptures can tell you more information in educational context. Like, you can look at it from all angles. And that brings me to two artists from Dresden, Germany, named Leopold Blaschka and his son, Rudolf Blaschka, who were glassmakers by trade. Mm. And in the 1800s, that meant things like glass costume jewelry, chandeliers, glass eyes for those taxidermied animals, but also for humans who lost their eyes, and eventually glass-blown lab equipment like beakers and things like that. And Leopold went through some hard times, like the death of his wife, and to cope, he started studying plants just for fun and maybe paint them. And then he started making glass models of them. And during a boat trip to the United States, he became fascinated by jellyfish floating in the ocean because he was like, oh, they look like glass too. So his hobby evolved into commissioned scientific glass sculptures, starting with sea anemones to hundreds of models of invertebrates that were made by looking at live specimens in saltwater tanks. So things like soft corals or other squishy marine creatures that couldn't preserve well. And these were mostly displayed in natural history museums because they were more lifelike than the ones in the jars and didn't need constant maintenance. Like, you could just stick it in an aquarium model.
Right. Wipe it down with some Windex every now and then.
Yeah. The most famous collection, or one of the most famous collections of Leblaschka's work, or the one that I think is the coolest because I've seen it, is the Glass Flowers exhibit in the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology. It has over 4,300 models of over 780 species of plants, from entire, like, blooms with their stems and flowers to really super magnified pollen grains. To, like, right now, their special display is made by Rudolph, and it's of rotting or moldy fruits. And it's, like, wild how accurate. So, like, these are the strawberries that
are they, like, making these now?
No, this is, like, his son continued his legacy a little bit through the late 1800s.
Okay.
They're not making them now. But yeah, this is like that a strawberry. Look like it a looks moldy like strawberry. A moldy strawberry. You just walk around and you're like, I can't believe this isn't real. There's like withered leaves affected by different diseases and plants at different stages of their development. And I just think it's very cool how their hobby turned into something that's been preserved in museums.
There's so much work, so much detail.
Some powerful widower energy.
Yeah.
Gotta redirect.
I don't know what to do myself with myself anymore, so I'm just going to make extraordinarily detailed flowers out of glass.
He probably just would have watched Netflix now. So that's okay, too.
I love it. Thank you. We'll put some of these pictures up at scishowtangents.org so you can see all the beautiful things that the Blaschka boys did.
A lot of sea creatures.
A lot of sea creatures. Sam, can you challenge this fact?
I think so.
All right.
I think I can do okay. Natural history museums and their mission to educate people about the zoology, botany, and paleontology of the world are constantly receiving specimens from all over the place, and this can occasionally include an unexpected specimen. So in the 1970s, employees at the Helsinki Natural History Museum in Helsinki, Finland, conducted a census of the spiders living in their museum. Sometime in the 60s, staff had started noticing some weird-looking spiders that were hiding, like, in shelves and in their kitchen cupboards and stuff like that. Mm. And upon further inspection, they determined that they were Chilean recluse spiders, thought to be the most venomous of all recluse spiders.
Okay,
so if
great.
You're not familiar with recluse spiders...
Glad that they found out by checking, other way.
I don't know how I guess they sent it to one of their scientist friends or something.
Yeah, well, like, they do that at museums. Yeah.
Recluse spiders are horrible. They're bony, horrible spiders that live in basements.
They have lots of bones.
Yeah, they look like they're made of bones.
Yeah.
They pop out when you least expect that they're underneath things.
I had one lunge at me once.
They are very aggressive generally, too, but they like to kind of like hide in a basement by themselves.
Yeah.
I just looked one up. I don't like them.
Oh, we have tons here in Missoula, too. We're probably sitting...
This species.
No, not this species, but there's probably one in this room with us at this exact because I've seen them down here.
They do like basements, yeah.
Yeah. And their bite is necrotizing, which means that it can like rot your skin, make your skin die.
Yeah.
And it can make you have to get skin grafts. Even worse than that, they can live for a long ass time without food and water. And one Chilean recluse spider in particular lived for 755 days without food or water. So they're like indestructible, basically. So back in Helsinki, the spider census revealed that they had a full blown infestation. Like you could open a cabinet and find dozens of spiders in the cabinet. And over the decades, they're still there till this day. Uh-huh. They've persisted through heavy remodeling, construction, and tons of like aggressive pest control tactics, like spraying down the whole place, and they keep coming back. No one knows where they're coming from, and each female recluse spider can have 1,500 babies in their lifetime. So it's like an unstoppable tide of spiders.
Yeah, you only need one. I also can't help but notice that Chilean recluse spiders are probably not from Helsinki.
Right, that was my next thing. Chilean recluse spiders, question mark, but they're in Helsinki. How do they get to basically like the exact opposite side of the earth?
Uh-huh.
Nobody knows. They're
in a box.
Our theories,
from Chile.
Probably in a box from Chile. There's theories that they came in a fruit crate, and there's theories that they came in a package of wood shavings that they had used for an exhibit in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody knows for sure, and at this point, there's probably not even any point to like try to figure out where they came from.
Yeah. They just got to freeze the whole place, because I imagine Chilean recluse spiders, like, they're not like getting out of the museum and wandering around.
Right, because so that's what...
It's got to turn off the heater.
I was reading a little bit about other ways they control pests in museums. There's a lot of studies on how to stop wood lice or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Things that eat wood, moths, stuff like that. They know how to stop them, and it is to freeze them out.
Mm-hmm.
But these spiders aren't infesting the art, which is generally when the people who run art museums decide that there's an emergency.
Right.
So they can't like put the piece in a freezer or something.
Right.
But I guess they could open all the doors up and stop them. There's only been one recorded bite. They warn people coming into the museum that it's infested with spiders.
There's a sign. It's like, hey, just so you know, these spiders are not part of the exhibit.
Yeah.
Do not touch anything in here, but mostly definitely the spiders.
But don't touch them. Yeah. You would think that they would be other places, but that census in the 70s studied the block that the museum mm-hmm. was on, and they didn't find any, and I couldn't find any other sightings of them.
Yeah.
So maybe it is just like nice and warm somewhere in there.
They've got a secret layer. They just took over
the museum.
Yeah. And it's built on top of old tunnels, so some people are worried that there's like...
They're going to get
there's
out.
There's a lot of spiders in the tunnels, or they'll get out and get into other places, but... Hasn't happened yet. Mm, so
that's a horror movie waiting to happen.
Maybe that's like an invasive species, but only in one building.
Yeah.
It's like a curse or something.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds. Yeah, like there's an amulet of the spider somewhere there.
Just like,
it's their punishment for like taking this artifact from whatever culture it belongs in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
They've got venomous spiders now.
That seems like the most likely explanation.
Yeah, you got to throw that idol in the ocean. Yeah. All right, we have to choose between the Blaschka boys and their amazing, accurate natural history glassware, or Sam and his Helsinki museum full of Chilean recluse spiders that are probably pouring out of an amulet. 3, 2, 1, Sam.
Very close.
Points.
I expected that. The spider story just really got to people's emotions.
I like that there's like an island enclave, you know, like they have a whole continent like of South America, but then also they're like, and here.
Mm-hmm.
This one creepy building. And that means that it's time to ask the science couch. So we've got a listener question for our couch of finely honed scientific minds. This one comes from @Clubja. Can you explain how art is cared for and or restored in museums without degrading the painting/sculpture?
Ooh.
I think that this is a wide ranging question. Like it is different for every, and then, like, you have to develop individual techniques for
like
individual
every painting,
things.
Basically,
I mean, for protecting things, like, you're gonna keep it away from sunlight is a big one. You put UV protective glass on. Mm-hmm. You could even say don't take flash photography of this, because like the combined effects of 5,000 flashes a month is mm-hmm. basically like having it be in the sun for 1 year every 20 years, and that's too much.
Because art is chemistry, right? The paint and the pigment and the whatever's binding it to the canvas, like those are all chemical bonds mm-hmm. that are happening. And so photons hitting it add a little bit of energy to mm-hmm. those bonds. So eventually mm-hmm. they can break, and that's when the paint starts to flake or crack or fade because the the molecules shift around. The way that they analyze these paintings has a lot, it's like a lot of organic chemistry. So like Stefan said, they can use techniques like X-ray fluorescence or mass spectroscopy to figure out what the pigments are made of and then figure out based on the chemical composition of the painting or the discolored varnish, what solvent they can use, which is basically something that they use to like dissolve just the top layer. Mm-hmm. Paintings are the classic example of restoration. So you'll like find a specific solvent for that varnish, put a little bit on and then like carefully scrape it off. And then you might coat it again with something that's developed more modern in more modern times so that it won't fade in the same way, like with more synthetic compounds inside it. Sculptures, they're getting kind of creative, which is interesting. I think because the material is so different, like a marble material from the like the surface deposits of minerals on top. So two methods that I found are laser ablation, which is similar to removing a tattoo from people's skin. So it's like you have a really high intensity laser that just like blasts at the correct energy level that it will blast off the dust but not break the stone, or is like absorbed by the dust and the grime but not the stone underneath. And so you when you watch people do this, I watched a video of this too, and they're just like shooting a laser beam at a sculpture. It's like magic because where they shoot the laser, there's no more dust, and they have a vacuum that just sucks it up.
This is how we're going to do my house in the future, right? Does that work on my toilet?
Yeah, I don't know, probably.
And I just like...
So anyway, the other way to clean sculptures or frescoes, which are like the paintings on stone, are breeding specific strains of bacteria.
What?
Which I think is really interesting. The one that I read about is called Pseudomonas stutzeri. It's commonly found in soil and water, and they can basically train it to grow on certain like glue-like substances in the agar gel and like feed off of the things that they want to remove from the frescoes to clean them. And that's then they spray it on the fresco.
I want that for
that
me.
That would work on your toilet also, I think.
I was thinking for my own body.
It's basically like those little fish that eat the dead skin.
Yeah.
After about an hour and a half in this one case, they just rinsed the surface with water and dried it, killing the bacteria. So they're like, they're done.
Thanks a lot.
Their task, they die.
I like reading about old-timey when they were doing... when they were restoring like Roman statues they found and they didn't have arms and heads and they were just like, I think his arm was probably doing this. And they just stick a different arm on him.
Yeah. I'd love to like glue a statue back together.
That would be great.
That'd be fun. Well, if you want to ask the Science Couch your questions, you could do that at SciShow Tangents, where we tweet out topics for upcoming episodes every week. Thank you to @Meljma, @HLToller, and everybody else who tweeted us your questions this week. Final Sandbuck scores. It's not very fair, but Sari has zero, despite doing the majority of the work. And the rest of us are tied with two.
Well, now I feel bad about it.
If you like this show and you want to help us out, it's easy to do that. First, leave us a review wherever you listen. That's helpful, and it helps us know what you like about the show. Second, you can tweet out your favorite moment from this episode. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just tell people about us. And if you want to listen to SciShow Tangents ad-free, you can do that on Luminary. Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
I've been Stephen Chin.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is a co-production of Complexly and the wonderful team at WNYC Studios. It's created by all of us and produced by Caitlin Hoffmeister and Sam Schultz, who also edits a lot of these episodes along with Haruka Matsushima. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Medish. And we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you. And remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted.
But one more thing. There is a fossil specimen in the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology in Alberta, Canada, called Ramphorhynchus, which is a pterosaur. It's a fairly complete fossil, which is cool in and of itself, but upon closer inspection, researchers found a little lumpy bit near where they think is its cloaca that is probably a coprolite, which is fossilized poop. The poop has little spines in it that might be from a small starfish or sponge or a fish. And if this poop is real, it'll be the first pterosaur coprolite we've found.
Oh.
Oh. Did a little poop as it was dying?
Yeah.
And where it just got stuck on its butt.
Yeah. The poop fossilized first, and then it died from that.
Dragged down, yeah. But butt first.
It doesn't fly anymore.